Welcome to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie coming to you from St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. My email address is bam@Catholicism.org. I can also be found easily on Twitter @Brother_Andre and on Facebook. The topic this evening is True or False Pope, Part 2. Our guest again for this episode is Mr. John Salza, whom we interviewed last week. He's a practicing attorney for over 20 years and a widely acclaimed Catholic apologist, writer, and speaker. He's the author of 11 books on a variety of Catholic subjects. Most recently, he's the author of True or False Pope, a 700-page work which he co-authored with Mr. Robert Sisco. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Brother Andre. Glad to be with you.
Thanks for joining us again. So we're going to pick up where we left off last week. And the next thing that I wanted to ask you regards Pope John the 23rd and his supposed membership in Freemasonry, in the OTO, which is one of the more occult Freemasonic lodges, and that under the canon law of the day, he would have essentially excommunicated himself by that crime, and it would therefore follow, according to the Certificandus argument, that he couldn't have been the visible head of the church since he didn't belong to it because he was excommunicated. What do you say of this theory?
Well, it's erroneous. First of all, it wouldn't matter because under the legislation of Pius the 12th. Any canonical impediment, including excommunication, was removed. It says that none of the cardinals, by reason of excommunication, can be excluded from the active or passive election of the sovereign pontiff, that is, either participating in or being elected to the election of the papacy. I mean, the church ensures that the election is valid, and this is one of the most important assurances that the church could possibly give us. And this legislation goes way back. We have, again, addressed this in depth in our book. It goes way back at least to Gregory the 15th in 1621. And the church is also unanimous in her theologians that when a pope is universally and peacefully accepted as such, which John the 23rd clearly was, by a moral unanimity, right? Not every single person, but by a moral unanimity of the church, then he's deemed to be the true pope. In fact, the theologians say that the acceptance of a pope by the church is the effect, the pope being a true pope, being the cause of that effect. And again, that is a unanimous theological opinion. Now, the Certificandus might rebut by saying, well, you know, it's not the canonical impediment, it's the fact that he committed the sin of heresy. Father Cicada would say this, and it's that divine law impedes the election. Well, based on what I presented, you know, last week, that's the dog returning to his own vomit. I mean, if the sin of heresy alone prevented the election, we would never have assurance who is a true pope, right? Sin is a matter of the internal forum. And so we would never know if sin alone was the impediment whether we had a true pope or not. And so to be clear, the sin of heresy alone does not cause the loss of office. It's the crime of heresy that does, and the church alone determines the crime. A second point on that, brother, is that if John the 23rd were a Freemason, that certainly would have been news to Pius the 12th, who made Roncalli a cardinal in 1953. I mean, Roncalli entered the conclave as a member of the Catholic Church in good standing. You know, we're not talking about Pastor Bob of the Methodist sect in Rome who entered the conclave. He wouldn't have been allowed to enter the conclave, but those who were members of the church in good standing were allowed to enter the conclave. And if Roncalli wasn't a Catholic, he would not have been allowed to enter the conclave. And third and finally, this is an obvious point, but that's mere speculation that he was a Freemason, right? I mean, one author says he was a Freemason. Another author says he wasn't. This is why we have the church. The church alone has the authority to establish these types of facts in the ecclesiastical forum.
Yeah, so there's a question of fact and a question of law, and we don't even know factually whether he was the a Freemason or a member of the OTO. Supposedly when he was in Turkey as a papal legate or something, he was observed going to an OTO lodge, but that fact hasn't been established. And then the law, the question of law is pretty plain because, as you pointed out, Pope Pius XII's legislation that he had put into effect, which of course would govern the conclave that happened after him, namely the one that elected John the 23rd, the rules for conclave made it clear that whatever reason for excommunication was lifted when the cardinals met in conclave, and they could both vote and be voted for as pope. Right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, Peter Diamond came up with one of the most absurd arguments to this. He says, well, you know, that legislation didn't apply to major excommunications for heresy, only minor ones. Little did Peter know that that distinction hasn't existed since the 19th century in canon law. And then admitting that he could be wrong, he actually says that the excommunication might have been lifted when he was elected, but then it automatically kicked back in. I mean, I've heard bad arguments before, but this is one of the worst. I mean, that effectively would say that would deny the entire purpose of the legislation, right? Mm-hmm. Here you have the cardinal proto-deacon saying habemus papam, and then according to Peter Diamond, yeah, well, now the legislation kicks back in and he's not pope. It's absurd. But again, this is the length to which they have to go to support their theories.
Yeah, and it seems to me a lot of this goes back to that question of visibility too, because if he was excommunicated for this reason, then the whole church acknowledges him, then you've got all of a sudden the church plummets into this empty shell, and there's only these invisible real Catholics, and nobody knows unless you have the special glasses to see them with, right?
That's right.
Another point about this, I remember reading Dom Guéranger's Liturgical Year years ago, and it struck me. I said, this is an incredible argument against sedevacantism. He was talking about one of these contested elections, and he was writing about the life of a pope saint, and who became pope after some contested election. I forget the particular pope he was talking about. But he said, he laid it down as a principle. He said, it is the teaching of the church that when the church is at peace, and when the Catholics of the world acknowledge a man to be pope, whether the election was contested or not, that man is by that very fact pope, that the church recognizes him to be so. That's why that makes him pope, that the whole Catholic world recognizes him as the pope.
That's right. And it's actually the fact that he is pope that causes, as I said, that actually causes the universal and peaceful acceptance. That happens because he is truly pope. Christ is not going to allow the entire church, the universal church, to follow a false pope. That's impossible, because being pope and the ability to promulgate doctrine and dogma to bind us, to save our souls, I mean, they're inexorably linked, right? So yeah. If we never had an assurance of whether we had a true pope, we can never be sure of the doctrine that he promulgates. And that's why it is a dogmatic fact. The theologians teach that it is a dogmatic fact that when we have universal and peaceful acceptance of a pope, we have infallible certitude that, in fact, he is pope. And we've had that from John the 23rd to at least Benedict the 16th. If someone wants to debate whether we have that for Francis, you know, because of the unprecedented resignation of Benedict the 16th, that may shine a spotlight on this theological opinion. But clearly from John the 23rd until Benedict the 16th, there has been universal and peaceful acceptance. And I maintain that we probably have that now, even though with Francis, even though if the church would come out and declare him an anti-pope, that's going to be the church's judgment. Again, it's not private judgment.
So, and by the way, when Abbot Guéranger is summarizing the opinion that you said is the majority opinion, or rather the unanimous opinion of theologians on this subject, of the peaceful acceptance of the church makes this man the pope, he's no lightweight. Because, I mean, he wrote the book Papal Monarchy, or Pontifical Monarchy, that was used by Pius the Ninth when he went ahead and made the definition of papal infallibility in Pastor Eternus.
Yes, that's right.
All right. So the next question is, granting for the sake of argument that the sedevacantists are right and that the corpus of Pope Paul VI is indeed laced with heresy on such things as religious liberty or ecumenism, and the striking departure from the theology of the Mass that Cardinal Ottaviani said in his critique of the new Mass, Pelagian concepts of human dignity and so forth. What do you say, granting that they're right, that he was, you know, full of heresies and published them, what do you say about the theory that his heresy excommunicated him and or otherwise made him ineligible for the office?
Well, I would say a couple things. One, you know, according to your argument, if you assume that they're right, that would only prove that there are material heresies mm-hmm. in Paul VI's teaching. But it would still not prove the formal or subjective element of heresy, which is the will, which is pertinacity. And that is what's required for the crime of heresy to be established and the subsequent loss of office. So even for the sake of argument that there are material heresies in Paul VI and other the conciliar popes' teaching, one still would have to prove the crime of heresy, which requires both the objective element, the material error, the heresy, and the subjective element. Both the matter and the form must be public, and they must be publicly adjudicated by the church. This, of course, hasn't happened. The other point I would make is that while there may be material errors and heresies, the Pope has never bound the universal church to believe in these things with divine and Catholic faith. And that's because it couldn't happen. Because again, the parameters of infallibility, according to Christ's promise of binding and loosing, apply only when the Pope, using his full apostolic authority, defines a doctrine on faith or morals that is to be believed by the universal Catholic Church with divine and Catholic faith. And none of that has happened during these conciliar pontificates.
Yeah, I remember reading that John the 23rd had promised, he had told a bunch of Orthodox priests, he had known them as seminarians, I think, when he was in Turkey. They came to visit him after he was Pope, and they were telling him, you know, gee, we wish we could be in union with you ecclesiastically, but, you know, you have this idea that you're infallible, and we reject papal infallibility. And he says, well, you know, you don't have to worry about it because I don't plan on using it. So, I mean, whether this anecdote is true or not, it's a fact that John the 23rd, Paul the 6th, John Paul II came close in Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, but the CDF under him came out and said, no, it was not an infallible declaration. He simply confirmed and reaffirmed that this is true, that this is infallible based upon the ordinary and universal teaching of the Church.
Yeah. So, and that's why, brother, I say that this isn't just a crisis of faith, but it is a crisis of authority in twofold. One, it's the crisis of the fact that these popes haven't used their infallible authority to teach us what we need to believe. Now, we already know what we need to believe to save our souls. We have the dogma of the faith. But the popes haven't reiterated that infallible teaching in any type of extraordinary way. They may have in occasions affirmed what the Church has always taught, and that's great, but they haven't issued any definitions. None of these conciliar novelties are matters of faith that bind Catholics. Mm-hmm. It's also a crisis of authority because Catholics have a false notion of obedience. They think that just because, you know, these men are popes and, you know, these guys wear red hats and long robes that we have to believe everything they teach. No, that, you know, there's a distinction there between true and proper obedience and false obedience. So this, we are dealing with a crisis of authority.
So what you said about them refusing to use the divine powers they're given, an example of this, I think, is Paul VI in Humanae Vitae. He did not choose to make an infallible declaration and instead left it at that. I mean, there were people who were telling him. I know a priest who wrote him a letter, said, you know, you need to make this an infallible declaration because all these liberals are saying that that's the only thing that could set that would prove us wrong. And he didn't. He didn't Yes. Make an infallible declaration. So the same thing that's said about Pope Paul VI could be said about John Paul II, who of course had a much larger output. He was Pope for longer. He was a very prolific writer, so yeah. There was a huge output. And you know, in the rather sort of turgid Lublin existential personalese in which he wrote, many things can be found that would seem to be problematic. But is there any special consideration given to John Paul II over, say, Paul VI, or is it simply an application of the same principles?
Well, the same principles always apply because the principles are true and the theologians unanimously hold them and the church teaches them through her councils. I would say that when John Paul II, you know, we also note, and what really bothered Archbishop Lefebvre was the fact that he engaged in, you know, communicatio sacris, this worship with non-Catholics. I mean, this is one thing that really troubled Archbishop Lefebvre. And so, you know, he took the error, I think, to a different level in terms of his praxis. But when you look at the 1917 code and the commentary on the code in terms of what a Catholic could do without being considered a public heretic, I mean, it's quite incredible when you read it. I mean, a Catholic could propagate heresy. He could engage in false worship, which is what John Paul II did many times. He could commit sacrilege against the Blessed Sacrament. All this is in the canon and in the commentaries, and he would not be considered a public heretic. He would only be considered suspect of heresy. So again, I think in the case of John Paul II, we could say he may have been suspect of heresy. He certainly gave us indicia that he may have lost the interior virtue of faith. God knows, we don't know. But at most, he would only be suspect. And again, the same principles would apply to him. There would have had to been warnings, which are issued, and we talked about this a little bit. They're issued in fraternal charity because the bishops and cardinals don't have any authority over the Pope. They would issue these warnings as a matter of fraternal correction. And if he would persevere, then a council could have been convened to declare him guilty of the crime of heresy. But again, that hasn't happened with John Paul II. It hasn't happened with any of the conciliar popes. And hence, according to the public judgment of the church, they are true popes.
Okay. So then we obviously don't have to give special consideration to either Pope Benedict XVI or Pope Francis, because it's the same rules apply. So Amoris Laetitia didn't change any of this, right?
As horrible as that document is, and as Catholics, we should be saddened and even enraged by it. This is just another on the continuum of conciliar novelties. Obviously, it's extremely problematic and extremely disturbing, but none of this binds Catholics in any way. I mean, even Cardinal Burke came out and said there's not even magisterial authority here. You know, this is the opinion of the synodal fathers that the Pope has approved. It's not binding. We recognize that he holds the office of the Pope, but we resist these erroneous teachings as good Catholics must do.
So the syllogism, the rather simple or simplistic syllogism that Sedevacantist will come out with it, a heretic cannot, major premise, a heretic cannot be Pope, minor premise, Pope X, and fill in the blank with conciliar Pope, has uttered heresy. And of course, especially if you're Michael Diamond, you can come up with a list of 812,000 heresies of whichever Pope. Mm-hmm. Ergo, conclusion, Pope X is not the Pope. That thesis founders on, or that rather that syllogism founders on the fact that, number one, a lot of these things aren't even material heresy that they say. And secondly, that even if they were material heresies, we cannot judge the internal form of another person and say that he's a heretic.
That's right. And I would even take it a step back and say that the major premise is wrong. A heretic cannot be Pope. It depends what you mean by heretic. That has to be qualified. A heretic cannot be Pope if he's a heretic according to the church's judgment.
Okay.
That type of heretic cannot be Pope. But an occult heretic can be Pope. And all public heretics were occult heretics at some point in their lives, right? I mean, this is how heresies ultimately manifest. But if an occult heretic, that is one who has, by an act of the will, rejected a dogma of the Catholic faith, if he can be a heretic, that means there is really no metaphysical incompatibility with heresy and jurisdiction until he commits the crime of heresy and then is severed from the body, at which time Christ would then take the jurisdiction away from the Pope. But until that happens, as we've said, until the church declares this, as long as the Pope is tolerated as Pope, He is considered the Pope. So I would say the conclusion is wrong from the false major, but you know it also cannot be drawn from the minor, because uttering a heresy, as we said, does not make a person a public heretic or a manifest heretic. It's a material error or a material heresy, but that's, again, just the material element. Many Catholics have made materially heretical statements. It's the formal element or the subjective element of the will that also has to be proven, and it has to be proven publicly by the Church.
All right, John, thank you. We're going to go to break right now, and when we come back, we'll be continuing our interview with Mr. John Salsa, talking about his book, True and False Popes. You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. Please stick around.
You're listening to Reconquest with Brother Andre Marie, seeking that which was lost and fighting for it. Exclusively on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.